The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Front pages of the papers, almost total unison in the lead story. The Business Post stands alone. They have a Red Sea poll showing that Sinn Féin is rising in support and the two government parties are trailing behind it. Every other paper goes with big splash pictures from the funeral of Pope Francis yesterday. The Sunday Independent has mourners in the front row, Emmanuel Macron and his wife, Donald Trump and the First Lady and a number of other dignitaries looking on as 14 pallbearers carry Pope Francis's coffin. The Sunday Times then has an aerial view of St. Peter's, the square, looking down at the serried ranks of mourners and of hundreds upon hundreds of cardinals, all in the Roman Sun. And the Irish Mail on Sunday has gone so far as to produce a souvenir edition. That's what they are describing it as. The front page has a white Dodge Ram with the coffin, one assumes, in it, and Carabinieri and Polizia on either side. And it says, "Final journey to his eternal rest." And then within the paper, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages of coverage from yesterday. Barry White, of course, our chief reporter, was there throughout. The final estimate being 400,000 people there with him. And of course, thousands more likely to visit the grave today when it opens later on. Barry White is with us this morning. Barry, how would you describe the events yesterday?
Hi, Anton. Good morning. Well, it was like anything I've ever seen or been to or reported on before. It was quite incredible. 250,000 people attended the funeral in St. Peter's Square, while afterwards another 150,000 people lined the streets of Rome for the funeral procession. But early yesterday morning at around 6:30, I walked and followed some of the crowds going into the Vatican to St. Peter's Square, and there was kind of a carnival atmosphere. Dozens of different nationalities who had travelled from all corners of the globe, many people draped in their country's flag. And then in the square before the funeral, you know, the sun was shining. It felt like people were waiting for a concert to begin. Everyone taking pictures and selfies, lots of people singing and dancing in different languages. However, once the funeral started, I suppose the singing and dancing stopped, the selfie sticks were put away, there was just a hush across St. Peter's Square and the adjoining boulevards. The 250,000 people who filled the square and the adjoining boulevards just went into complete silence as they were told that Pope Francis wanted to build bridges. He was a man of peace. And there was certainly a sense of peacefulness in the square yesterday during the funeral as those tens of thousands of people watched on.
When you and I spoke yesterday morning, Barry, one of the things that we were discussing was that the sort of the simplicity of the coffin of Pope Francis compared to the pomp and ceremony of both the event and the location. Did that sense of simplicity, did that continue into the burial?
Well, look, Anton, I wouldn't say yesterday was low key, but it could. I don't think anything could ever be called low key with so many world leaders gathered in such a small place like they were. You know, 150 delegations attended, 50 heads of state, including US President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky. The security operation was one of the biggest Italy has ever seen. Snipers were dotted on roofs of buildings around St. Peter's Square. Helicopters and drones were flying overhead. There were 2,000 police officers there, 1,000 members of the National Guard, and hundreds more people working in security. So it wasn't a low-key affair. However, parts of it were low-key. Pope Francis was buried in a simple wooden coffin, and there was a simplicity in the funeral procession. The simple wooden casket was transported in a Pope-mobile. It was just basically a pickup van. The white van carrying the papal coffin then just slowly went through the streets of Rome. It went past the Monument to Victory. It went past the Roman Forum. It went past the Colosseum and then arrived at the Basilica of St. Mary Major. And there was just silence on the streets of the Italian capital during the procession. As I said, there was 150,000 people on the streets for this procession, but you wouldn't have known it because it was just silence. And all you could hear was the bells tolling from the Basilica. And then as the coffin was led into the basilica, a group of young children, some of them who are homeless, some refugees, they placed white roses in the coffin before the burial. And there was a simplicity to that as well. But regarding, was it the same kind of pomp as we normally have for Pope's funerals? Probably not, but I wouldn't say it was low-key. The Vatican has stayed tight-lipped about the specific cost of yesterday's funeral, and they haven't responded to requests for figures. So we might know that at a later date. I think the last two funerals of Popes, Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II, cost around 10 million euro. So it'll be interesting to see what yesterday's cost as well.
You said earlier on that the numbers in attendance at the funeral are expected, when you look at the total people expressing their sympathies and condolences, they're expected to rise today because people are going to visit the grave. Are many expected other crowds?
Yeah, the tomb in St. Mary Major Basilica, where the Pope was buried yesterday, has opened to the public this morning, and thousands are expected to visit. I've seen pictures of queues outside the Basilica from early this morning, and look, it's very, very noticeable how busy Rome is this weekend. I know it's always a really busy city, but speaking to restaurant staff, hotel staff and taxi drivers last night, they said this is the busiest the city has been in years. There's also a jubilee of children on this weekend, and that's coincided with the Pope's funeral. So the place is just busier than ever. And I was kind of walking through the city centre last night, and you're walking at this snail's pace because of the crowds that were around. It's just it's so packed here.
We were one of the things that sets this funeral aside was that thing that we were discussing about was that the Pope's desire for it to be, in as much as it can be, a relatively simple affair, the coffin, the burial place. One of the other things that seems unusual was the sheer level of politics that happened. We saw Zelensky getting an applause when he arrived in, and an awful lot of the coverage today is referring to that unexpected bilateral meeting between Trump and Zelensky in St. Peter's.
Yeah, I think yesterday, Anton, the media, when they were looking and covering the funeral, when you were looking towards the world leaders, you were kind of looking to see where Donald Trump was seated and where Vladimir Zelensky was seated, to see if they were close to each other. Then the word spread that they had actually met. And then this image was released by Zelensky's advisors. A defining image indeed. And this actually marked the first face-to-face encounter between Donald Trump and Vladimir Zelensky since that, I suppose, disastrous White House meeting in February, when the US president and other US officials publicly berated the Ukrainian president for being insufficiently grateful for US support. And the photographs released by the Ukrainian presidency showed the two leaders huddled in a close discussion without aides in the surroundings of St. Peter's Basilica. Quite a striking image. And then after the funeral yesterday, Donald Trump posted on Truth Social questioning whether Russian leader Vladimir Putin wants a peace deal. Now, our own president, Michael D. Higgins, was asked about this when he spoke to the media yesterday evening. He was asked what that meeting could mean for diplomatic relations. Could it bring peace between Russia and Ukraine? However, instead of wanting to talk about who was at yesterday's funeral, President Michael D. Higgins wanted to speak about who wasn't at it. And he criticised Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for not attending yesterday. But he also said it's outrageous that people who are criticising the Israeli government's policies are being labelled as anti-Semitic.
Really referring to such people as anti-Semitic. If you criticise a Prime Minister who is stretching an arm that is in breach of international humanitarian law, many other aspects of international law, if there is no respect for civilian rights in relation to women and children and such a huge proportion and so on. And remember as well also that to be free to criticise that is that the automatic other great lie, which was that because you were expressing those sentiments, you were supporting, for example, a military version of Hamas, which would support us absolutely untrue. I have to say, from the time since the events of the attack, the original, the Hamas attack and the response to it, I cannot assume a kind of indifference. That image that won the international press, a photograph the other day of a child with no limbs saying to his mother, "How can I embrace you now?" Today, we've had a wonderful gathering here in Rome of representatives of government and state. How could any of them remain silent then? If you are in fact actually starving people to death by blocking the food, blocking medicines, blocking the basic water itself, the basic necessities of life. And I think that it is, how have we become numb? I think when you think of his own concept, Francis' own concept of indifference, that's what he meant.
And Barry, just to clarify, that was in response to questioning about the relationship between Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah, it was. He was asked about that striking image, but instead of, I suppose, commenting on whether peace could be, whether the Russia and Ukraine could be on the verge of peace after talks between Trump and Zelensky, Michael D. Higgins wanted to talk about who wasn't there, and in particular Benjamin Netanyahu not attending the Pope's funeral yesterday.
Well, thoughts now, I assume, turn to the conclave and that process.
Yeah, the papal conclave. I think I'm completely fascinated by the conclave and how it works. And I think a lot of people are. I was actually looking. I think there's maybe almost 10 million people have watched the movie The Conclave since the Pope's death. So there is a lot of interest in this. And it'll be held in Rome in the coming weeks. It must begin no earlier than 16 days after the Pope's passing and no later than 21 days. Therefore, the earliest the conclave could start is May 6th. The latest is May 12th. So we know who the next Pope, we will know who the next Pope is within the next 2 weeks. And at the conclave, cardinals under the age of 80 are eligible to vote, and two-thirds of a majority is needed to win. So there are currently about 135 cardinal electors. How long will it last? It depends, really. The longest papal conclave lasted 3 years. It took place following the death of Pope Clement VI and went from November 1268 to September 1271. So it took 33 months until Pope Gregory X was finally elected. However, in modern days, conclaves typically last a couple of days. Pope Francis was elected after just 5 rounds of voting in under 2 days. Now, this can be a fairly unpredictable process. Pope Francis wasn't really in the reckoning in 2013, so someone unexpected could be his successor. I was asking a lot of journalists who are based here in Rome and based in the Vatican yesterday, who's the next pope going to be? People were telling me it's just completely unpredictable. But there was two names that kept being mentioned, and that's 70-year-old Pietro Parolin. He's the Vatican's chief diplomat. And 67-year-old Luis Antonio Tagle, a Filipino cardinal, and he's one of the youngest in the running. So they were the two names we mentioned yesterday. But as I say, there's dozens of cardinals in the running. And Pope Francis wasn't even really spoken of before he became Pope 12 years ago.
Well, you said you were fascinated by conclaves, Barry. If you have access to a radio, turn it on and stay with us, because in a while, Dr. Miles Pattenden, who's historian of the Catholic Church at Oxford, is going to walk us through all of the various different options and what happens and what used to happen and all the rest of it. Meanwhile, Barry, thank you very much. That is Barry White reporting for us there in Rome. Although I should say my next guest would arguably be able probably to do the same task in walking us through the details of the conclave. Michael Kelly, Director of Public Affairs for the Papal Charity Aid to the Church in Need. And the Pope, of course, was the head of your charity.
The Pope was head of our charity, and I was due to meet him actually on May 8th. That had been the plan. So I'm not fully sure now if we have a new Pope by May 8th. Will I be meeting him? I'm going to Rome this day week anyway for the conclave, but that all depends on how quick the cardinals are. And I'm sure whoever is elected Pope, the first thing in his mind will not be meeting Michael Kelly.
Well, nonetheless, it would be nice to get in the early days if this was possible. Give us a sense then of how well you think the funeral reflected the man, and how well the eulogy reflected the man and his ideology and intent for the church.
Yeah, I think Cardinal Ray's homily really was a tour de force of the main motifs of Francis's papacy. He mentioned mercy a lot. I mean, this was one of the first things, the first Sunday that Francis was elected Pope. He said, you know, we tire of asking for God's mercy. God never tires of offering us mercy. And to me, I think that's a kind of powerful powerful antidote in our world today, because it's almost as if we live in a world where everything's permitted but nothing's forgiven. We're a very unforgiving world, and you know, our politics is dominated by the person who can shout the loudest. You know, might is right. The era of strong men, people talk about. Francis, you know, was a humble man, was a man who was not afraid to show vulnerability.
I mean, now, on that, Cardinal Ray was pointed. Now, he was pointed in Italian, which may have meant that it didn't land quite as much as well. But he made some points about immigration. He made points about Francis visiting the US-Mexico border, visiting the Isle of Lesbos during the European immigration crisis. Do you think any of that will have had an effect on the people, the very clearly chosen people in the audience?
I think it was an important reminder, and I think that's what the Cardinal was trying to do. He's saying, you know, if you're coming here to honour the Pope, if you're coming here because you respect the legacy of the Pope, let's be realistic about what his legacy was. And his legacy was very, very challenging to many politicians. I mean, there are few politicians who could go to a meeting with Pope Francis and find themselves very, very comfortable at the meeting. I mean, Francis was a kind of Pope who people often tried to co-opt to their own agenda. So, you know, would have kind of, you know, left-leaning leaders, you know, would be very pleased when he would talk about climate change. You know, they'd be less pleased then when he would talk about euthanasia or abortion, for example. So he was a hard man to pen in.
On one aspect of it that is evident in the pictures that I mentioned across all of the front pages, gender diversity within the church doesn't seem to have made much in the way of inroads during his tenure.
No, that is certainly true. I mean, all of the clerics that are involved there, the cardinals, the bishops, the priests, the deacons, all male. And that's very noticeable on one side of the altar. Of course, it's a lot more diverse on the other side when it comes to the dignitaries and the world leaders. And Francis, this was one of the enigmas about Francis, in a way. He introduced this synodal process, this global consultation of Catholics worldwide, and said people can talk about anything. You know, you have to, whatever is in your heart, you should bring up. And one of the key issues came up was the role of women in the church. And one of the issues that emerged from many parts of the world, including Ireland, was the desire that many women have to become priests. Now, Francis was asked about this then in a television interview. I mean, the clip is really quite something, because the question is really quite long, and he simply says no. And that is the only word he says on the issue. So there is that perplexing side to Pope Francis at one level, where he opens up this global consultation. He raises expectations from people because, you know, nowadays, if you ask someone's opinion about something, they expect that you care about their opinion, or you might be inclined to do something about their opinion. And then he completely shuts it down. So I think that that's a kind of challenging part of his legacy that I think will still have to be worked out.
Michael, stay with us, because after the break, we're going to be joined by Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway, and Joan Mulvihill, who's digitalisation lead at Siemens, to look obviously at the legacy left by Pope Francis, but also about the political implications of some of the moving and shaking around the funeral, because that meeting between Zelensky and Trump is being seen as hugely significant, as is the subsequent social media tweets, or rather truth socials, if that's the right term, that Donald Trump put out for the first time questioning Putin's motives. More of that after we give you a shot at the cash machine.
News Talk's cash machine.
Well, Nicola Ash was at home when we called. She didn't even believe it was us at first, and then she realised it was, and the celebrations began. The good news is, of course, we're going to have another winner. This time it's going to be on Friday, because it's a guaranteed winner, and the person is going to walk away with the biggest cash prize ever given on Irish radio. More than a quarter of a million euros up for grabs. It's a guaranteed winner. Taking part is easy. We give you an amount, you take a note of it, you enter, and if we call you and you give us the right number, you walk away with the money. Cash machine amount, 251,000 euro exactly. Text the word play to 57557. That's 57557. It'll cost you €2.50 plus your standard message rate to play. You have to be over 18. You're playing across the Go Loud network of stations, and full terms are on newstalk.com. Get your entry in by 3 p.m. on Friday. Cash machine will then randomly pick one entry, and it could be you that gets the call during Sean's show. Answer within five rings, tell us the right amount, and the cash is yours. Don't answer within five rings or get the amount wrong. We will keep going till we get a winner. That number, €251,000 exactly, text play to 57557. People are saying real prospect of peace in Ukraine, given the positive pictures and reaction to that bilateral between President Volodymyr Zelensky and President Donald Trump. We'll discuss that and more after this break. Michael Kelly, Director of Public Affairs for the papal charity Aid to the Church, is Aid to the Church in Need, I should say, is staying with us, as is Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at University of Galway, and Joan Mulvihill, digitalization lead at Siemens. We will return to those issues relating to possible moves towards peace in Ukraine emanating from the bilaterals at Pope Francis' funeral. To domestic matters first, and the front page of the Business Post: reprieve for Harris as SF soars. This is that Sinn Féin is up to 24%, Fianna Fáil is at 20%, and Fine Gael is at 19%, but it's 19% on and up, which theoretically means a bit of a sigh of relief. I imagine, Larry Donnelly, Sinn Féin must be seething that they didn't manage to get these numbers to overlap with the general election.
Yeah, absolutely. I would take a little bit of at the word soaring. I mean, this is kind of margin of error stuff. I mean, up 2%, I think, since the last poll. Obviously, given how low Fine Gael was in the last Irish Times poll at 16, even though it's only 3% up from that, I think they will take some satisfaction therefrom. I'd make a couple of points, though. Number one, I'm just not sure about the utility or the merit of polling done at this big of a remove from the next election. I'm just not so sure what it tells us. The second thing I would say is, at least in the near quarter century that I've lived here, I can't remember as boring and listless a time in Irish politics, in the sense that we had a protracted debate over speaking rights, which I think was of little utility, you know, and I think a lot of people tuned out of. And
great excitement, though.
Great excitement for the insiders and for the political correspondents, perhaps, but for, I think, for the general public, not at all. And I think that, you know, in terms of a lot of these issues, you know, look, we're only having committees formed now. How many months on from a general election? We're in a real period of kind of an odd period, I find, in Irish politics. And a lot of it has to do with the Trump presidency and how we are going to respond to the threats and tariffs and everything else. So domestic politics has been almost in a state of what I would call suspended animation to an extent.
Simply because we're watching to see how we react to events across the water.
That's a big part of it. Yeah. And at the same time, the big issues, and I know we're going to talk about housing, but the big issues haven't gone away and they need to be dealt with very badly. So once we get, I suppose, once some sense of normalcy, I think, resumes, because the fact is, of course, we're exposed due to tariffs and all sorts of other things emanating from the United States. But if you're one of those people who is desperately trying to afford a house, that is your biggest issue. That is your biggest priority. And I just wonder what people make of what's been going on and how the a little bit of frustration that might be seeping in among the general public about getting to grips with these. And perhaps that's why Sinn Féin, if not soaring, now is the biggest party, at least.
Would you share Larry's view that this is one of the dullest periods in Irish politics in recent memory?
I hate to be agreeable, but yes, I do think it's I think it's a really interesting observation. It's amusing from a reality TV show nonsense around
what, the speaking rights thing
that dragged on and everyone was watching in and tuning in and who was shouting at who today. But I mean, fundamentally, it's boring and dull if you're trying to buy a house or you're trying to move forward with your life. If you're a small business and you're trying to deal with all of the challenges of that, and then you're a large business and you're dealing with tariffs. One of the things that I would say, and it came up in a conversation I was having earlier this week, we seem to be lacking any real vision for what the country is and who we're going to become. You know, it's 100 years since the Civil War. It's 100 years since the foundation of the state. And I seem to have lost touch with where we're going and who we want to be as a country and what we stand for and what we can build. So a lot of the stuff around housing and there's other things in here about, you know, building an IFSC 2.0, all of that, we seem to lack vision and passion for where we're moving forward.
But the Sunday Independent would suggest that we're investing fairly heavily in vision and passion. Their front page has new housing czar McDonough. This is Brendan McDonough, formerly of the NTMA, the National Asset Management Agency, or rather the National Treasury Management Agency. He's going to retain his salary when he left NAMA of €430,000, is going to be responsible for knocking heads and creating action on housing.
Well, investing is an interesting word, €430,000. I don't think it's a question of money. I think it's a question of direction. And it's actually a line that is in one of these articles is that it's, we've got, there was, what was it? at least with former Housing Minister Dara O'Brien, there was a sense of action, but maybe not direction, but action. We can throw money at it. We can be active, but to what direction? Other than build more houses. But where's the targets? Where's the bit about pulling it all together? And actually, we were talking in the room before we came in here. And Michael, you raised the point. Like, you know, we have housing minister and junior housing minister, and now we've got a housing czar, and we've got another committee, and we're going to throw more money at it. And I was amused. I obviously, we know I work for Siemens, but I drive past Leixlip all the time. The epic moving of mountains of land that was moved to deliver that Intel project over the last number of years. Can we have the project manager from there? Like, that's someone who literally knows how to move mountains to get something done. And the idea that we're...
Although it has to be said, they're cutting their global workforce.
Well, I know that they are, but that's... But I'm talking about
massive implications
as
for Leixlip.
As an infrastructural construction project. If we're just to look at it at that, and one of the things that they've mentioned in the article here too, is that what we've done is we brought in another civil servant to... Humphreys to manage a whole team of Humphreys is the way they describe
it. Let's go to that because there's a source mentioned in something. You know, Michael, you might have a view on this. It says that the housing czar is going to be responsible for a strategic housing and infrastructure office, which will be established, and a housing activation delivery group, as well as a housing activation industry group. And a source says there's no patience for roadblocks. This unit is being seen as a rapid response to the issues on the ground. This isn't another committee to jump through. And there's quotes saying things like, if you need a bridge, we'll get you a bridge.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me a lot of the early days of the peace process, you know, when we were having like talks about talks and, you know, proximity talks and various things like that to try to lead up to something substantial. I mean, I really hope the housing czar is just not another gimmick. My entire adult life, I've been listening to politicians in this country saying the housing crisis can't be sorted overnight. I don't know anyone who thinks that it can be sorted out overnight. But you know what? There's been a lot of days and nights since then. I mean, I remember when the homeless figure crossed 10,000 and there was talk about, you know, this is epic. We must never allow this to happen. And every month the figures come out and it's up and it's up and it's up. It's over
new record yesterday,
now.
15,800.
So every month brings a new record and, you know, more scratching of heads and more announcements that it can't be fixed overnight. I mean, I don't think money is the roadblock here.
Will they not say that what they are doing is now the solution, that they are taking one of the most qualified public servants in the country and equipping that individual to say, get a team together and have access to head of the ESB, head of Irish Water, head of the Department of Housing, and get stuff moving.
But with the exception of the absence of the Green Party, we by and large have the same government that we had running the country up to the last election. Why now? Like, why suddenly now has there become an urgency for housing czar? Did somebody wake up after the election and think, you know what, we need someone who can talk to Irish Water, we need someone who can talk to the ESB?
Presumably the answer to that, Larry, is the reason why now is the clock is ticking electorally. If they don't get this solved by the next election, there's hell to pay.
Absolutely, and they're squarely behind the proverbial eight ball on this one. If we look at the housing stats this year, they are down and down considerably. The new Minister for Housing, James Brown, is already under pretty serious pressure. So the time for action is now. And I don't think that the government parties should underestimate the degree among the public to which there is an appetite for a radical solution. And here's where there may be some room for parties on the left to make some gains. For instance, Rory Hearn is writing in the Mail on Sunday about this French savings scheme. Now, we don't get any of the details as to exactly what it is, but it is that sort of bang, big type of action that I think that the public want, and I also would say is very badly needed. We cannot rely solely on market forces to do this for us. It is not going to happen. I think that most people would agree with that. I think most people view some role need for state involvement. Of course, there's cynicism about what the state can deliver, but I think some people do believe, most people do believe that the state has a role to play here, and I think the general sentiment is all the issues...
But there's not much that can be achieved, Larry, before you get to big ticket silver bullet stuff. I mean, if you talk about the delays and how challenging planning is, if you talk about the delays and the warnings that Irish Water has given about connection, the same thing with AirGrid and the ESB and how difficult connectivity is. If you talk about the capacity to access capital, if you started to tick off those boxes, surely we'd see an improvement.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. There are all of those issues. And, I've spoken to Ivan Yates about this, some of the things that builders face into, and there's all sorts of issues and obstacles. But here is the blunt political reality, is that a substantial swathe of the population is going to look and say, yeah, but this just isn't good enough. It's not good enough that we have so many people, in need of housing, that the supply is short, that the demand is huge, and the cost is exorbitant.
Joan, you're eager to come in?
I am, because actually one of the things, and you're quite right, there's a certain amount that can be done in policy, there's a certain amount that can be done in delivery and execution. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that we all have to acknowledge is that we are all part of the planning process, and we have to stop objecting to everything that people want to build because we don't want to build in our back garden. We have to get over our NIMBYism, because I'll tell you one thing, if you don't like what they're putting in the field behind your house now, you are definitely not going to like what they're going to put and propose to put in it 5 years from now. The density requirements are going to go up and up and up. So we need, if you want to have some control over it, we have to get more open to what people are building. And we all have an opinion about what we want on our road and what we don't want on our road. But we have got to stop, get out of this mindset of objecting to everything.
Sorry, Mike, for 1 second, because there's an awful lot of reaction. Back to the day when local authorities, we need to get back to the day when local authorities built the council houses, rent paid based on one's income and then a tenant purchase scheme. Many people today are second and third, maybe fourth generations living in these homes built by local authorities in the 30s and 40s and so on, when the country had very little comparatively in the way of its economy. Is it time for a cross-party group to be created to solve the housing crisis? This has gone beyond politics. Sorry, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point about local authority housing. There almost seems to be an allergic reaction from policymakers about local authority housing. I mean, this was something that worked quite well in Britain in the 80s. For example, Thatcher had this concept of the ownership society, that people should buy their council houses at substantial discounts. And these were people who would never afford a home on the open market. The problem became in Britain, and the problem became here then as well, when those homes were bought, they weren't replaced. So they went decisively into the private sector and, you know, were sold on then. And, you know, it was a wonderful opportunity for working people actually to have an asset then that they could hand on to their children. So I think there's a lot of thought should be given to that. What Joan's saying about planning, there's a kind of disconnect I find very often in Irish people. You know, there's an obsessive worry about the value of property, for example. I mean, when the announcement was made that the Old Saxe Hotel in Donnybrook, you know, was not going to be used as a direct provision centre, I mean, the relief reported in all the papers was people there talking about the value of their property. They're so pleased that it's not going to go down. Just before Christmas, I met an elderly couple that I know, and, you know, I met them in the street and, you know, I could tell they were a little bit upset, and they told me they'd just been to the post office to mail off Christmas presents to Australia. And, you know, they're quite upset because at best they see the grandchildren like once every 2 or 3 years, something like that. And, you know, so I sympathised with them a little bit. And then they asked me if I was going to the local meeting to ensure that the old shopping centre wouldn't be turned into a housing development. And I mean, I didn't point it out. It's not necessary that their children would live in the housing development. But I think there is that kind of disconnect that we don't realise that objecting to planning or, you know, wanting to kind of preserve my view has real world effects.
The other thing that there's a lot of reaction coming into is the suggestions that there were positive bilateral outcomes between President Trump and President Zelensky at the funeral of Pope Francis. Texts say, a real prospect of peace in Ukraine? All that has happened is Donald Trump has finally caught up with the rest of the world. Nothing material has changed. That may be the case. What's interesting, though, is what Trump has been saying afterwards. He, on social media, said there was no reason for Putin to be shooting missiles into civilian areas, cities and towns over the last few days. It makes me think that maybe he doesn't want to stop the war. He's just tapping me along and has to be dealt with differently through banking or secondary sanctions. Too many people are dying. That's a fairly significant change in the mood music. The other thing that's getting a lot of reaction is, any thoughts or comments on our president yet again taking an opportunity to have a go at Israel? He has a one-track mind. Well, we'll address that.
I think what should be said there as well about the president criticizing Netanyahu for not going to the funeral. There are many things, of course, Netanyahu can be criticized for, but he is also an observant Jew, and you know, a Christian ceremony for an observant Jew is not always the most comfortable space religiously for them. So, I mean, I think that's an important consideration as well.
We'll expand on that in 2 minutes. We're looking at the political fallout from Pope Francis's funeral, the most significant obviously being that meeting between Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump, and Trump's subsequent public criticisms of Vladimir Putin. But of course, domestically, Michael D. Higgins used the opportunity when asked about that meeting to talk about Israel. Larry, I was intrigued by the fact that he was talking about Pope Francis's message of peace. It seemed odd that in that context, his criticism was almost entirely for Israel, not for Hamas and the October 7th attacks.
Yes, I mean, look, I don't think Michael D's positions on this conflict are any great mystery or unknown. I think, you know, he's very strongly sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. I do think it's regrettable.
One can be that, though, and critical of Hamas terrorism and murder, can't you?
I think it's regrettable any time that any person, whether a public figure or a private individual, condemns Israel, and I think rightly for a lot of the things that Israel has done, but then does not in the same breath say what happened on October 7th is absolutely inexcusable and was totally abhorrent. That should start the discussion. Then the discussion follows with that having been said, the historic treatment about by Israel and Palestine, et cetera, and the response has been grossly disproportionate and violative of international law and everything else.
Tech saying, very proud of our president, Michael D. Higgins, and his stance on the unjust war. If you have a view, 53106 or 087-1400-106. What do you make, then, of the meeting that Michael D. Higgins was actually asked about, which was that bilateral, which doesn't happen by chance. You don't just pull up two chairs in the corner of St. Peter's and have a bit of a chat. So we assume there was intent behind it. And then we have Donald Trump, for the first time, threatening further sanctions on his friend Vladimir Putin. Significant?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that that image, that photo is one that will stand the test of time. I think historically we'll look at that picture forever because of the two people involved and the setting in which it took place. In terms of Trump, people are saying, has he had a U-turn? Has this been some sort of religious conversion or anything like that? I don't think so. My own view is that he, and people are surprised that he's taken on Putin, who many people think either has something on him or he has sneaking admiration for. I won't go there. But what I'll say is this. I think Trump, people are ascribing wrong motivations to Trump. Trump's motivation here is purely political and purely so that he can declare a win on the home front. Remember in the campaign, he said that the Ukraine-Russia thing never would have happened if he was president and that once in office, he would solve it in 24 hours. Now, of course, that was fanciful, and he's even admitted as much himself. He's saying he was using a figure of speech. What he wants is to be able to say, I brought about a peace, and to come home and say, promise made, promise kept. And he's convinced that a big sway to the electorate will say, well done, Donald, the out of the deal, you use unorthodox methods,
but does he
but
not
you
get
did it.
Closer to that by starving Ukraine of support and resources and pushing them into a capitulation rather than attacking Russia?
Well, I think, look, he's trying to, that's one way of looking at it, but he ideally what he would like to do is orchestrate the two of them sitting down and coming to some sort of peace deal. Now, my follow-on point to that, and again, I'm not upping the president's morality or anything like that. The follow-on point to that will be that if it breaks down, if it's not sustainable, he will say, look, I did the deal. It didn't work out, but I have successfully recalibrated that conflict, that Russia-Ukraine conflict, as a European issue. Now, Europe, this is yours to go and handle. And he's banking on the fact that his people in the United States will buy into that and say, well done.
Your theory is that this is not some major change within Trump. Joan, you're the opposite. You sort of believe this is a Damascene conversion.
No, I think what's interesting, the only thing I find amusing or different about that tweet was he said, maybe Putin has been tapping me along. Now, that is literally the first time he has ever admitted that someone may have played him. Because, you know, he's smarter than everybody in the room. He knows everything. And he's saying, maybe Putin has played me. Wow, that is a bit. But I think it's not that it's this road to Damascus moment. I think it is possibly he's there at that funeral and he is confronted with mortality. He actually probably will die, like everybody else. And he's looking at this adulation, this global weeping and mourning for this leader. And he's going, how do I get myself a big crowd like that? Well, maybe if I do something cool here. And then people will see me in the Vatican almost like a reincarnation of this Pope-like charisma for peace and this vehicle for peace. And maybe I'll just use that to get, because I think he wants a victory. And he doesn't care whether it's Ukraine or whether it's Russia. He doesn't care. As you say, Larry, it's about winning. Mm. But the only thing that I thought was different was maybe he was tapping me along. That surprised me. It's not often he admits.
And Zelensky was very encomiastic subsequent to the meeting. He called it a good meeting. He said, we discussed a lot one-to-one, protecting the lives of our people, full and unconditional ceasefire, reliable and lasting peace. Very symbolic meeting that has potential to become historic if we achieve joint results. Thank you. Big difference from the White House visit, isn't it?
Huge difference. And I mean, that photograph, Larry's absolutely correct. That photograph is iconic. I mean, I was doing the broadcast for the Pope's funeral on another station yesterday when that came in on the wire. And the first thing that struck me by it, you know, and I think anyone with a Catholic imagination at all will look and say, it looks like they're going to confession. Now, I'm not sure who's the confessor and who's the penitent, but that was the image that struck me. Just meters from where the body of Pope Francis was laying. I mean, and the venue is no accident here either. I mean, the Vatican has been doing diplomacy for 1700 years and generally doesn't have a selfish interest in conflicts. They don't buy oil, they don't sell oil, they're not really interested in things like that.
So 1700 years ago, they tended to meddle a bit, didn't they?
Over the years, things have changed, particularly under Pope Francis. But it's a kind of neutral space in a way, and the fact that Putin wasn't present, the fact that Putin didn't come to the funeral, I think cleared that as well. But certainly the mood music coming from Zelensky is very, very positive. And I think what's interesting about, you know, Joan saying this about Trump's Truth Social post as well, about, you know, that maybe Putin is being playing him. I wonder to what extent Trump is so influenced by the last person he met. And maybe Zelensky said something to him as simple as, have you ever thought, President, maybe you're being played here? And this is playing on his mind on the plane on the way back as well. And he'd be obsessed now, but Putin possibly getting one over on him.
It'll be interesting to see what emerges. 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. If you want to get in touch, 087-1400-106. It is, according to the Sunday Indo, we're on the edge of the 15th anniversary of the death of Gerry Ryan. And there is a piece written by his girlfriend of the time, Melanie Vervoord, recalling him as being a phenomenal man. But in it, she talks about that at the end of his life, he felt deeply betrayed by so many of his friends who never saw him anymore. And when he turned to some of them for help, the answer was always no. What did you make of the piece, Joan?
Well, I mean, obviously it's 15 years and a lot of time has passed. It's obviously very sad that anyone would feel that lonely and that rejected at the end of their life. And particularly someone who was used to a lot of public adoration. And it does show you that contrast between what's going on in someone's private life. You know, how you can be lonely in a crowd and millions of adoring fans, but no one really close to you. And that it is very sad to think that someone's last days were filled with that, but also incredibly.
But as well, when
but
you go
also
through a marriage breakup, friends are put in a position where they say, listen, I'm going to get in the woodwork here for a while and I see how this settles out.
Yeah, and also I think it's a very difficult thing to put out there for people to read who were his friends, who will feel very hurt by that. And I wonder to what end or what gain it is sharing those stories. I mean, to be fair, I don't think it's right to have said it. You know, I think it's not fair now. He's passed. His friends are still alive, and I don't think levying that kind of guilt on them is appropriate, to be honest with you.
You know, I also think, you know, if it depends, sometimes the expectation around friendship can be very high. I think, you know, if you have a half a dozen close friends in life, you're doing well, and it might be
half a dozen, you're setting the bar very high, Michael.
And, you know, it might be that, you know, the Horseshoe Bar in the Shelburne Hotel or the Ice Bar in the Four Seasons Hotel, you know, maybe the people there whose company you enjoy, maybe they're not necessarily your friends.
15 years, you talked about 25, your quarter century in Ireland, which meant you had 10 years of exposure to the Gerry Ryan Show. As somebody who arrived in to him as a personality, what did you make of him, Larry?
I thought immensely talented, you know, no question about that. Real ability to connect with people. A cousin of mine here, she revered Gerry Ryan and I think mourned his passing. He had that ability, I think, across the airwaves to make you feel like he was your friend. And I think that should never be overlooked. He made made a difference in lots of people's lives. And I don't think that should be understated. And, you know, clearly he had his demons. They've been well documented. Very sad to see what his last days, as Joan said, turned into. And all I can say is, you know, his family has gone on to do very well. And I'm sure he would be very, very proud of them. And may he rest in peace.
And I saw a piece in one of the papers yesterday referring to the Jerry Ryan shaped hole in RTE that still exists. And I think if you look at it in terms of just cold-blooded commercial terms, that is very much still
exists. I saw that too, actually. And I thought, but they kept trying to, the article went on to say that they kept trying to fill it with social media influencers. And I think that's also a recognition that the times have changed. Is there a Jerry Ryan shaped hole in the lineup, or is it that the world has just changed and the shapes are all different now and people are much more transient in terms of the relationship that they have with broadcasters or how much they're listening regularly? Obviously, you would leave an enormous
Of course, yeah, there'd be days of mourning were I to depart. No, the only thing if you take an Ian Dempsey as a case in point, Ian Dempsey continues to hit those numbers year after year after year, even in that setting. A text to say, is there any hope that planning and building and designing houses can be done with respect for the environment? Look at Galway, it's a mess. Take the dog. Monstrous glass buildings, take Barna high buildings both sides of the street that block out light. Buildings should not end up as an eyesore. And another, and we'll end on this note to send him off on a high. Thank you, Larry Donnelly. Always the voice of reason, cutting through the clutter. Trump is a narcissist and will use this as his quotes Trump card. And your other contributor is also correct. Either of you can take this one. Because Trump sees everything as a photo opportunity. He is self-serving. I hope President Zelensky isn't in line for a fall. Guys, thank you very much. That is Joan Mulvihill, Digitalization Lead at Siemens. Michael Kelly, Director of Public Affairs for the Papal Charity Aid to the Church in Need. And the voice of reason, Larry Donnelly.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.